Hey fam, what's up? This is part two of the two-part episode. Enjoy. Yeah, there was one time I got into an argument or a debate about that, about, you know, doing things or working with white people. And I was kind of saying, if you're going to do real world politics, unless you're going to really talk about picking up a gun and doing a revolution, and if that's what you're into, you know, by all means, do you. I mean, I wouldn't broadcast it on a podcast or any place where the FBI is going to be looking. But if that's what you're into, then, you know, so be it. But as far as I can see, you're tweeting, you're writing, you're getting a PhD. You're not like the spooky sap at the door, as far as I can tell, unless you're hiding it really well, you know? So I don't understand how you can talk about black liberation, but you claim that you don't ever want to educate white people. You don't ever want to work with white people. And I'm not saying like write for the white gaze or do whatever for the white gaze. I'm talking about just basic like politics, like organizing, doing local politics. I'm like you're not going to get anything without being able to build coalitions and do stuff. And all they can hear me say was what they heard. The same way the other person heard me say, colorism doesn't exist, even though that wasn't what I was saying. All they heard me say was, oh, you want to do this for the white gays, or, you know, you want to pander to white people. I'm not saying you gotta pander. You can play hardball politics with them if you want. You could be like, look, here's our list of demands, and if you don't take these demands, we're not going to vote for anybody. We're going to sit out the election. That's not pandering or kissing ass. You're not buck dancing for Joe Biden or anything, but it's still being pragmatic about how you're going to interact. Because like, white people have the money, they have the power, you know. But these people want to talk about stuff like group economics and buy black. I'm like, there's not enough black business to cover everything that we need. Let's be realistic.
But these are all recycled. It's like we're living through the 90s. The
same stuff.
These are all recycled talking points that we had progressed.
Here's the funny part. After they said all that, you know, and by the time I was done talking with them, I'm like, man, am I doing too much stuff with white people? I started looking at stuff they're doing, and they're doing all this stuff in front of white audiences. And I was like, wait a minute, the audience you're in front of, I wouldn't even go in front of that audience. Like, the audience is a waste of time to me, you know? And they're going to these front of these audiences, guesting on podcasts, doing all this stuff as voices of black liberation. And then I was like, okay, I don't get it. Like,
the performance is for that audience, and that is why they've cultivated this identity that's in such opposition to white people that they define themselves by white people. It's still a definition controlled by white people because it exists in direct opposition to them, and it exists so they can fulfill that role that white people love, which is that sort of S&M dynamic where you lay them bare and vulnerable, and you attack them, and you tell them how bad they are, and they clap for you, and it's cathartic. It's like they went to their dominatrix, and you know that you're making money off.
And not only are they making money off of it, in a way it's kind of cathartic to them too, because I feel like they weren't lying to me. I think they really bullshitted themselves into believing that they weren't cooperating with white people, because in their minds they're going to all these white audiences and then telling them about themselves. So I guess
I just haven't met that many people who were sincere in that regard.
They're totally not sincere, but they get to lie to themselves and tell themselves.
I'm sure they like, but at the end of the day, I don't think you can lie to yourself that much. But yeah, I got a thing with white men and handshakes. I've had it since high school. It's always cracked me up. You'll be a little white guy. I'm a big dude. I'm not someone who's particularly violent. And I don't think it's like some great thing that I'm a large man. I'm 6'6", 250. But every once in a while, there's a little white guy wants to shake my hand, and he does that super firm handshake. At some point, he was taught that you show someone you're a man by shaking the shit out of his hand, right? And I always have this moment when my hand's getting squeezed where I think, what if I pulled my hand back and just looked at him and said, but what if I fucked you up?
Yeah.
You know, like, now let's drop it. Now, so you showed you were a man through the handshake. But now, you know, let's get down to brass tacks. What if I grabbed you by the neck and put you up against the wall? Would your handshake have saved you? So what is this charade? Now, of course, I wouldn't do that because I'm not violent like that. But I feel the same way about blackness. Like, I remember I ran into a black dude who was a writer and who is extremely black. You know, he's always he's black as fuck with the t-shirts, black, this, black, that, love bluesy black girls, all that bullshit, right? The aesthetic blackness, the slogan earring, the aggressive t-shirts, right? And I saw him at a function and I was relating a story to him. I don't know him super well, but I was just like saying, some white guy in the lobby, crazy white guy, one was telling me his whole life story. And he made this kind of sly comment like, oh, you sure do seem to interact with white people a lot. And I was like, you know, it's kind of like the handshake. Like, I guess, who are you doing that for? A homeboy, my family's generations deep in the hood. You've never been around the Negroes I've been around, bro. My homeboy got killed execution style by infamous drug dealers in Winston-Salem, my best friend. My cousin did time for, you know, holding cocaine. He got out and then got shot in a nightclub. Now, these are not positive attributes. But my point is, buddy, you don't want to be around the people I've been around. And I also don't think you would last 10 minutes around my family, as much spades and fish fries and all this shit and the jive you talk online. I don't see you really being in that room with my Uncle Vernon and being comfortable. So who is this act for? And this goes back to Crew, where she was bullying people. This is what people do. You know, it's like, oh, I don't like, you can't hang out with white people and you're this and that. And you're looking at them the whole time. It's like, but you're a phony. But, you know, like, you have now started to bring this act to people who know better. And that's when the hubris and the narcissism goes so far that they're actually performing in front of people who know better. You're like, whoa, this is not
Control.
And
that's where I think, because she changed different types of blackness and POC-ness. But yeah, that's where I think the Afro-Latina thing ended up being her undoing, because she wasn't being nice like the other guy. And on top of that, she's trying, and a whole bunch of Afro-Latinas just kind of compared notes and just called her out and exposed her. But meanwhile, all these other dumb fucks are tweeting about, I was so traumatized, I'm a victim because she gaslit me, and you know, this is why black women are never listened to. And I was like, you should be even ashamed to tell the story, dude. You should not. If I got like that, I would not be going around trying to like even in that, they're trying to get a grift, get that trauma. You called it social justice disaster capitalism. Even in that, they're trying to like shake the tin cup. They're like, yeah, I was
absolutely.
I'd be ashamed. I wouldn't go out there and make a 50 tweet thread.
What about her statement? Her statement was incredible, right? You know, when she, you know, obviously she was going to be outed. So she preemptively declared, you know, I have been, you know, whatever, I have committed violence, please cancel me. Even in that statement, she is using the universal Esperanto, the language of blackness online, to write about her abuse, her perpetration of the fraud. And like you're saying, even in castigating her, these same people are going back to this script. Like, they can't, where is the sincerity? Where is the original thought? You know, why is it still, you're still within the same framework. You're operating within the same framework of the grift. You're absolutely right about that. It's painful to watch.
Yeah, and there's a lot of dark-skinned Jessica Krugs out there. There's a lot of black, dark-skinned women Jessica Krugs. There's a lot of gay black men Jessica Krugs. There's a lot of straight black men Jessica Krugs out there. Do not be fooled. And part of the problem is a lot of these people, they can't call out what really is the problem with Jessica Krug, because if they do, they're going to be exposing their own grift. Like, I use the analogy of like mutually assured destruction, where it's like, if I go to like the whorehouse, because I'm taking this from an episode of Mad Men. In Mad Men, this episode where one guy goes to the whorehouse and sees his father-in-law in the whorehouse, and they both look at each other, and then he's like, who's going to tell who that, you know, if you tell your daughter, my wife, that you saw me here, she's going to have to know that you were cheating on her mother. And I feel like Jessica Krug was like that episode, you know, like they were both doing the dirt together. I mean, not together, but, you know, in the same place, in the same way. And if I call you out, I'm kind of calling myself out. So I think that's why they got to do the colorism thing. They have to do it's about black women not being heard. Because what is the truth? To me, the truth is there's a lot of imposters with melanin who are only getting by because they can physically pass for black and no one's asking them to pass the smell test. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of figured it out and weaponized it for her own benefit. That's number one. And number two, quite in opposition to the idea that everybody's against black women, they're actually very trendy in the Academy now. And she wasn't there to the exclusion of black women. She kind of got in because they're kind of collecting black women like Pokemon now in a lot of these academies and these spaces. And that's not to denigrate black women who do good work, because there's a lot of black women who do good work. I'm denigrating the white liberals who are doing the picking, you know? A lot of different black people get the turn as mascots. You know, there was a time when black men were the mascots. Everyone wanted Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, Dave Chappelle, you know, and Dave Chappelle kind of had to go to Africa because he kind of realized what was happening to him. Like right now it's black women's turn. They want, like I said, her department had a lot of them. She was able to come in because right now that's the trendy thing. Trust black women. Black women will save us. Black girl magic. That's the new hot brand in these circles. That's the new hashtag. That's the new hot type of tweet. But if you say that, what does it say about you, the writer? Like, you know, now people got to look at you. If you describe the real symptoms of everything going on, then you also kind of reveal, hey, I'm in the whorehouse too, partaking in the same thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you have to, you know, there's something that that stuck with me long ago was there was a study about the sociopathic brain and short-term memory. And it was really fascinating, this study. It suggested that, you know, because if you've had a friend who's grifty and sociopathic, you know that one of the things they do fucked up shit. And you see them the next day and they act like it didn't happen. You know, they're like, hey, let's have a drink. It's like, bro, you tried to bag my girlfriend last night. Like, we can't move on from that. And they'll act like they don't remember it. What this study was saying was that the sociopathic brain actually damages its own short-term memory because it begins to realize that in order for the sociopath to be healthy, it has to not have a good short-term memory. It has to forget. So it goes from like, yo, this person's pretending that they don't remember all the bad things they did when they were drunk, to actually the brain has made itself break. So they really don't.
Yeah.
All right. And so I think what you're saying is very similar to that, which is just like, I used to think people didn't see the grift. And so I would point it out like, hey, I know you're into this person, but do you ever notice that there's a lot of product placement she's doing and her writing's not particularly good and she's extremely sadistic, just like Donald Trump, and she's building a brand and she's a narcissist, and they would still not see it. And I realized it wasn't that they didn't see it, it's that they admired the grift. They were unable to see it because they were very similar to that person. So they have a large blind spot. So I agree with you. I think that these people cannot assess what Krug was perpetrating, because to assess it, they would have to admit their complicity. And their brain will not allow them to understand that about themselves, because then they would collapse in on themselves.
I totally agree. I'll even add something else too. I think a lot of times, boundaries are very changed. Like when I was growing up, a lot of us used to like freestyle and ciphers and stuff like that and do little things, but very few of us, except the people who are serious about it, really thought they were ever gonna rap. Like we just like to sit around the lunch table or sit in a cipher and rap.
Sure.
But you always knew like one or two guys who they thought they were gonna rap. And after school, for example, they would go to a studio or they knew somebody. You know, like there was like four guys in my school that one of them was Russell Simmons' nephew in my high school. And him and three other people, they would go after school like every day and rap in the studio. They're really trying to be a group. But now with the influencerization of everything, with TikTok, with social media, a lot of people think, you know, and it's very cheap now. You can get like Fruity Loops on your or GarageBand on your phone and make a beat, you know, like you don't need to like know someone. There's no barrier to entry. A lot of people think, you know what, if I tweet enough, if I'm visible enough, I might actually become a writer. I might actually end up at The Atlantic. I might end up a rapper like Lil Nas X. You know, I if I tweet enough, I might end up acting if I do whatever.
Sure.
I think in addition to what you said, I think what you said is absolutely right. Like this is not in contradiction, but an additional factor that compounds it is they, if they're not sociopathic themselves, you know, they think I can't really let myself spot the mechanism and how fucked up it is because I need that mechanism to be in place when it's my turn.
Yes. The mechanism has opened the door.
Yeah, I want to take advantage of that mechanism myself. That's my hope. And I even think with people like Donald Trump, and Kim Kardashian, for example, right? I always tell people Ronald Reagan, Obama was Trump before Trump, as in he made celebrity and being an influencer, like why was he always releasing Spotify lists? Why was he doing book club lists like Oprah? Like you're the president. Why are you? And he was preparing so that when he left office, he could be like the post-presidential Oprah. He does.
That's you get into tough territory.
People don't want to hear that, but
territory.
He's not doing any statesman like stuff. After he left office, he's not doing any Jimmy Carter stuff. All he's doing is signing Netflix deals.
He had a tweet the other day, or an Instagram post someone forwarded me, where he was saying, "How are you all feeling, America? Text me and Michelle at this phone number." I mean, you talk about token, meaningless activism. Obama's very difficult. He's a significant figure. He's a significant figure. Absolutely. Symbolically, I rooted for him. I called my friend when he was elected. What it meant for him to be elected was very different from who I thought he was. You know, I wasn't naive about it. And who he was in office was problematic, you know, at so many different junctures. And who he's been post office is kind of galling and shocking, but it is really hard to get people
to be reasonable.
Really difficult.
And oh, sorry, I think you were still talking. Sorry.
No, that's all I was going to say.
I think it's hard to be reasonable, but I think it's also hard for people to admit that the roots of it were always there. Like when he was running, he was always scolding black people for the white gays. And he was always like very vague things like hope and change, vague type of things. But then even before Obama, you could say Ronald Reagan was, if Obama was the first influencer president, then Reagan was the first celebrity president. You know, I feel like influencer is a degraded version of celebrity, right? But I think what makes Trump different is he doesn't even put the window dressing on it. So, because I think the same way you said the sociopath breaks their own brain so they can't really realize what they're seeing. And I was saying that a lot of people want the grift to stay the way it is because they're planning to take advantage of it in the future. There's also a part of them that doesn't want it laid bare what it is. They can't take it. So they want you to dress, dress it up. So people call Ronald Reagan the great communicator, but he still kind of act like he was a great statesman and not just like a prop that they put up because of his charisma and his celebrity to pass a bunch of heinous right-wing things through. They want to believe that Obama gave him that option too. Like he's not as, I can lie to myself when I look at him and say he's not a sign of the degradation, the celebrityization of everything.
Sure.
He was a real true politician.
Look, my colleague, I have a colleague named Rich Purcell, extreme hyper intelligent professor, the only other black person in my department. He in fact co-wrote a piece with me this summer when we were talking about these bland empty statements that universities released to protect the brand in the wake of the George Floyd killing and police violence, right? Rich is so sharp, but one of the things he said to me at one point was he did not trust how angry Trump made white people, because he said he didn't think it was a sincere anger, but it was the rage of recognition. Beautiful. It was that Trump was making it tacky. He was, you could no longer deny the grift of whiteness. Like, you know, it's almost like a mafia thing where it's like, there's a way you do these things, kid. Yeah. There's a way you do these things. You keep a mistress, you put her over here.
Appearances. You
know,
like, you have to keep appearances.
He was just, And so, I agree with that. And actually, I agree with the Obama connection and almost inserted him in the piece I did about Krug, but it didn't really, it wasn't a seamless transition.
And you're throwing in enough bombs, I think it would have detracted.
But I thought it would have, you know, distracted because he's such a polarizing figure in the sort of emotions he engenders in people. But I recall when you talk about people learning a script of blackness, nothing about Obama's blackness did anything for me when he performed it. So like, you know, he would go on Ellen and hit an awkward two-step and people would be like, oh, that's Obama. He's got soul. Right, I'm like, bro. Oh yeah. Obama doesn't dress like he's cool. He doesn't do cool two-steps. His playlists don't make any sense and he clearly doesn't make them. Like none of that was doing anything for me. And I was shocked by the people who would buy into it. But when you believe in people who are working from a script, then what happens is you get these moments. Like, I don't know if you remember, I think it was after the South Carolina shooting, after Dylann Roof shooting, when he's on stage with all the pastors and he drops low to hit that note where he's like, Amazing Grace. And everybody stands and cheers and he's black. He's being black. But that's also the same guy who gets on a stage in front of that black audience in Flint and pretends to take a sip of water and leaves Flint without changing a damn thing for all those black people who are suffering. So I don't watch performance. But people do. It resonates.
It totally resonates. But if you look at things he even said in that performance, right? I don't even like the Dylann Roof thing, because there were two things. I did an episode just about that speech. There are two things that if you stop and think about them, if you like get past the optics of it and stop and think about it, you kind of realize that whole thing was for white people, and that whole thing was performance, not even for actually the black people in the audience. There were two things. One was Amazing Grace, the only thing close to a black spiritual. It's not even a real black spiritual. It's really a white spiritual that a lot of black people sing, right? But it's not like a real black spiritual. But if he sang like it, first off, the effort it took to learn a real black spiritual, I think he wouldn't care to do. But also, no white people would recognize a real black spiritual. So he had to choose the most.
Sure.
It was the same as his Spotify playlist, like lowest common denominator, easy recognition, mimics like every other playlist or book list right now. But the second thing is, he said, God works in mysterious ways to describe the killing of all those people. And what was God trying to do? He was trying to show Dylann Roof and white supremacists the resilience of black people. You guys know how insulting that is? Can you imagine him going in front of the Boston Marathon victims and said, you guys all got blown up by a Muslim terrorist, but let me tell you something. Now that Muslim terrorist knows that you guys can take a lot of punishment and God wanted him to know that, they'd be like, get the fuck out of here. But black death, black life is so cheap.
Black death is such white noise. Yeah. We're all used to it. We accept it as a fact of life. That's true. But Obama's gift, if you can call it, his magic act, is he could make the blandest non-statement sound like some sort of grand declaration. And it made people feel comforted. You know, he had a tone about him. So he's a great politician. And I don't mean that as a compliment, but he's good. Like, I've met sociopaths who are almost admirable. They're so good at their grift. You're like, yo, this motherfucker is cold. Like, that's how I felt about Obama sometimes. I was like, man, he is really working it. I see through this, but the rest of the room doesn't. And I can't say anything about it. They'll turn on me.
And one of the reasons that sociopaths and narcissists are so good at that is because they cut corners on the actual craft. Like, if you're doing a lot of work on the real craft, like Obama wasn't really going deep on the governing. You know, he was doing the popularity part of being a politician. Like, he was just running an 8-year campaign all the time. Even in the second term, he was running a campaign because he had to be popular post-presidency to be a full-fledged influencer and stuff. And part of the problem is, like, that's why sociopaths and those narcissists tend to be really good at stealing credit and giving blame. That's something they're very, very, very good at, because you can't do the hard work it takes to be genuinely brilliant a lot of the times. Sometimes it happens. I'm not saying it never happens, but, you know, a lot of times to be a really good climber and all that stuff, it's a skill. You got to work on it. And there's only so much time in the day, and your craft will suffer. And that's why I think a lot of these people that we talk about, these black melanated Jessica Krugs, tend to be pretty mediocre. And it's also a reason why I'm kind of surprised that Jessica Krug ended up being as actually good at scholarship as she was. Mm-hmm. That's not typical to me, as far as I see.
Well, you know, the problem for her was that this grievance and sadistic nature started to bleed into her personal life. She was on dating sites performing this. She was testifying in front of governmental commissions. I don't think it's coincidence that so many of these people, these white women, were also, like in her case, also an activist. In other cases, purely activists. I mean, Dola Zhao with the NAACP, that woman with the incredible name. What is it's like? Satchel Paige Lynn or something, where she just took Satchel Paige's name and tricked it out. No, you don't know about her. God,
how many of these people are there?
Hold on, you don't know about the one in Indianapolis?
Nah.
Satchel Paige.
Sounds like a bad character.
Yeah, Satchel Paige Lynn Cole is her name, and she went so far as to have a photo with a black man, but they're sitting on a stoop, and she talked about the time she came out.
Oh, I know this. Okay.
And it's not her father, but she has a picture with him. And if you recall, Rachel Dolezal had a son too, and she had a fake father who she posed with. I mean, they're basically requesting or hiring black people to pose with them in photos. The grift gets deep with them.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
they're really
going for it. It's pretty crazy. But always, the tip-off is there's always grievance and always victimization that makes you unable to challenge this story. So even when she introduces her Black father, it has to be in the context of my gay identity that I was expressing to him. You know, it's there's always something more about identity that confuses you. It throws you off the scent because you're so paralyzed by saying, oh, this is yet another identity. This person was this person was that, they went through this, they went through that. And so I started looking at because social media, I was talking to I have a friend who's actually a big name as a talking head, and I would never use his name because our conversations are private, but his celebrity is, you know, obviously, like, I'm not going to name drop or put him out there because he tells me things in confidence. But one of the things we were talking about was Black people on Twitter are always upset about shit. It's like someone was tweeting, was like, man, sometimes I see people, Black people with my same last name, and I think, I wonder if we're related. And I see white people with my same last name, and I think, did your ancestors own mine? And I'm like, bro, I see people with my last name and don't give it a second thought because I have a busy fucking life, fam. I'm living out here. Like, y'all spend 24 hours a day being upset about shit, and I don't believe it.
Yeah, aren't they even really upset?
Because my life really was about homelessness and struggle and all this, and it's not something that informs my every waking moment. Whereas these people who are complaining all the time, sometimes you look and it's like, yo, this person has hired a personal chef? That person has 5 book deals? Like, why are they complaining all the time? And you start realizing that that is the fundamental ingredient for this sort of incontrovertible identity built on grievance. You can never challenge it, because to challenge it would be to violate one of these codes that they picked up on.
Some of the rage is real. It's just not really what they're pretending it's about. Have you ever heard the term? This is a term in psychology called narcissistic rage. I think they carry a narcissistic wound, and they have this low simmering, free floating narcissistic rage that is always ready to come to the surface whenever there's narcissistic
injury. You're 100% right.
So, like, I agree with you. They're lying about being mad about what they claim to be mad about, but they actually do carry, I think, a lot of genuine rage.
And that's why they're sadistic. You're right. And this is why you can't believe they behave the way they do on Twitter. These are people who are professional. They've achieved. I'm not going to name any names because what's the point of it? But like, there's a journalist who's incredibly famous and accomplished. And every time anyone sends me one of her tweets, she's attacking someone. There is no slight that is small enough or minor enough for her not to insult this.
What's funny is I'm very sure a lot of people know what you're talking about. But
no, and it's like, but why are you so fucking angry? What deep inside you has made you so wounded and angry?
Petty? She's really.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, if I had a platform and some money and security the way some of these people do, you wouldn't see a single fucking tweet.
But that's the funny
thing. I would be off enjoying myself.
Like, the more successful they get, the imposter syndrome doesn't end. The emptiness inside doesn't end. It's like if anything, they just get madder and madder. Like they get, with the irony of people with that narcissistic wound and narcissistic rage, each time they get higher, they realize that nothing's being filled inside, and that paradoxically actually makes them angrier at everybody, because they're like,
oh, of course,
how can I have this and I'm still not happy? But they can never blame themselves, so they still have to direct it out.
They have to drag the world down to their level of misery, and this is where they coincide with Trump. That's where they overlap. Trump knows that he is obese and hideous, and his hair looks like shit. And one of my closest friends, we're no longer friends, but one of my closest friends for over a decade was a guy I met in college whose family used to vacation with Trump. All right. His family really had money. His father was a top 3 plastic surgeon in the world. This is way back before Trump was on the scene for president. My man told me, he said, you know, we had to stop vacationing with Trump because everyone knew he was broke, and it was embarrassing. Like, Trump was rejected by those blue bloods, by the New York aristocracy. Like, nobody respected him. So he carries this anger toward white people, and anger toward upper crust culture, and anger toward women, and anger toward everyone. He walks into rooms and he cannot ever be the person that he is projecting, which is why the projection is so strong. And these people are the same way. They were never cool. They didn't have friends, which is why their online friends are so important to them. They didn't have admirers. And you get the sense that they will never be satisfied, even with 500,000 followers, even with people complimenting their photos, with you're in a photo looking like a pile of shit, but people are like, you're so beautiful. And you're like, thank you. Like, that sort of behavior is very Trumpian and very
sadistic. Part of the problem with those type of narcissistic wounds happen usually in your childhood. But the same, like, there are age-appropriate wounds and age-appropriate times to treat them. And if you don't treat a narcissistic wound, a childhood wound, at the time it needed, like, you know, when you needed mirroring from your parents or affirmation from your peers, mm-hmm. if you go to, like, a therapist, what they'll tell you is you have to treat it like something that died. You have to mourn it, go through your five stages of grief, you know, deny that you're mad about it, then have anger about it, then bargain, like, why didn't my mom love me? Why wasn't I cool in high school? And, you know, you reach a point of acceptance. But it's kind of like how Michael Jackson never grieved that he never got to have a childhood. So that made him just hang out with kids the rest of his life because he was trying to fix a childhood wound at a time where it wasn't age appropriate. Like, you can't do it. Like, no, if you're 40, you can't go to high school and be the cool kid on camp. You know, you can't go back to college and be the big man on campus. You look stupid wearing the Letterman jacket at 40.
Sure.
That's what, like, that narcissistic rage is that you're trying to fix something that is too late to be fixed when you should be mourning it and then letting it go. And, like, low key, like, Obama had a lot of that. If you read his biography, if you ever see, like, how thin-skinned he was when people got on his nerves. But again, sure. Obama was able to always maintain the illusion that he wasn't thin-skinned, you know, that he was above everything. And these people, like, need their illusions. One more example is Kim Kardashian, right? This guy was telling me how much he hates Kim Kardashian. And I'm like, you know what? I actually don't mind Kim Kardashian for one reason. At least she's honest that she's just famous for being famous and for mm-hmm. people wanting to have sex with her, right? And because I was like, give me an example of someone who's as popular as Kim Kardashian that, you know, right now, that you admire. And at the time, it was like 2005 or something. And my friend goes, okay, Jessica Simpson. Right? Because at the time, she was kind of popular and stuff. I'm like, okay, what's your favorite mm-hmm. Jessica Simpson song? You know? And he couldn't think of it. And then he said, like, oh, wait, she had one for Dukes of Hazzard, but he couldn't give me the name. And then I was like, okay, have you ever had one of her albums? You can't even name her stuff. What do you know her for? All you know her for is you think she's hot. She was on a reality show. And she's one of the people that does 10 hustles like Kim Kardashian. She has a fashion line. But if you ever look up the deals of the fashion line, she doesn't actually design any of the clothes. It's just a clothing company came to her and said, can we license your name? And she just signed her name off on it. I mean, I'm like, she's Kim Kardashian, but what she has is she has the decoy career. She has the decoy talent. She says, I'm a singer. And by having that decoy talent, everyone can now lie to themselves and say, hey, we like her because she's a singer / fashion designer. But then in reality, they're free to now just enjoy her on the Kim Kardashian level. Kim Kardashian doesn't even bother to say I have a decoy talent. So now she's almost indicting you. She's like, I dare you to turn away. You know? Sure. But if you're going to indulge in me, you're going to have to admit what you're doing the same way as.
This is all so foreign to me, you know, because this isn't an act. I've never been able to understand celebrity worship. Mm-hmm. It's just, I can't figure out why I'm supposed to care what John Legend is doing or whatever, Chrissy Teigen. Like, you know, I believe that they posted a photo of her after a miscarriage or the baby died or was stillborn or something. And I remember people talking about it, whether it was appropriate and people being on one side or the other. I'm not on either side. I can't imagine caring about it at all. I just, there's so many people in this world. There are people who are close to me who are going through, you know, genuine emotional turmoil or just living their lives and raising their children. And that's interesting to me, but I don't understand Jessica Simpson, Kim Kardashian, or any of these.
You know, a book broke it down for me. I'm not going to take credit for it. There's a book called The Image by Daniel Boorstin.
Oh, yeah, of course. Daniel Boorstin. Yep. He's referenced in the piece we wrote this summer about for the Chronicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the one that made me, after I read that book, I looked at Kim Kardashian and I looked at Obama and I looked at Jessica Simpson. I'm like, these three people are all doing the same thing. There's only just one that happens to be honest about it. Like, we reached the same way Obama revealed, and so the same way Trump revealed, you don't have to even pretend to not be doing what you're doing. You can just openly be a racist. You can openly be a circus barker. You can openly be a reality show influencer. And, you know, people still vote for you. But the flip side of that is you'll get a lot of haters who are mad that you're flipping the mirror back on them. I feel like Kim Kardashian figured that game out early. She's like, I don't even have to pretend to be doing anything more elevated than what I'm doing. You know, why even pretend? This is just who I am. Here's one of the last things I want to bring up about the colorism thing that you brought up earlier. One added dimension about what's very insulting about the colorism claim is you were talking about how it shortchanges like black people and how they define blackness. But in a bizarre way, it shortchanges white people too, because it kind of renders them as people being so clueless about black people that they can't tell an authentic black person from one performing, to the point that their only marker, their only clue is to just use like a paper bag test. And, you know, and so if there's like a really dark skinned black guy who is dressed in a suit with like tight pants and talks like you know, whoever, Leave It to Beaver, and there's like a light-skinned dude who just got out of jail and, you know, has all the trappings of like being from the hood, he's gonna be like, well, I guess this dark-skinned guy is the one to be scared of, and this light-skinned guy, like it's really silly, and it's not even,
of course,
realistic. White people know black people in a lot of ways better than we know ourselves. Like, they study us, they give us our pathologies, and then they exploit it later on, and whatever. Like, it's just a very fairy tale thing to even say.
Well, to believe in a perception of blackness on behalf of white people that's that simple is to abandon all nuance. And usually the people making these arguments show that they have, you know, pretty sharp critical faculties, and then to subtly abandon nuance there and be like, you know, there's colorism in the academy, and therefore no one could tell that this wasn't. Yeah, no. White people spot this shit all the time. And you're right. They're the ones who give us our pathologies and our concepts of blackness in some ways. And I've been seeing this since I went away to school. One thing I realized was the angriest black people that I knew tended to be suburban black kids who had grown up around white people their whole lives, because they'd grown up around them. Mm-hmm. And they're close. They're in close proximity to them. My family doesn't know how full of shit white people are.
Yeah.
I know that because I went to prep school. That's why I always say I'm an integrationist. It's not because I'm white aspiring. It's because being in proximity to the top 1% of white people in this country allowed my self-esteem to be maintained. No matter what black people say, so many of them loathe themselves. They really do. They bought into it. I'm cooler than most white people. They're lucky to have me around. I've always known that. I know that because I went to prep school and saw a bunch of buffoons and idiots who were going to succeed in spite of themselves. Once I saw that, there was no turning back for me. There was not going to be any self-loathing. You know what I'm saying? So now those people, most of the black people I knew who were, you know, their parents were judges or in finance and et cetera, they really see up close the absurdity of the fact that they can't advance past a certain level. Whereas my family don't ever even get to see how cheated they've been in this life. So they don't feel that same rage. Now, the other thing is they've been going to school with these white people forever. And someone like me or one of my family members walks into the room, damn right white people know the difference between us. They like that fucking kind of authenticity. They want to talk hip hop with me. They want me at their party. You know what I mean? Like, that this means something. Whereas the other kind of black person to them is just, it's kind of just like a white black person. There's no edge there. So they know very well. And this is why those black people begin to perform. They start to realize that to be on the stage, you've got to play the part that flatters the sensibility and desire of the white audience. And it kills them inside, but they do it because they want that damn stage.
And that adds to their self-hate, because I'll give you a great example. You ever see A Soldier Story?
Nah, what is that?
Oh my God, A Soldier Story is amazing. You gotta see A Soldier Story. A Soldier Story is a play. Well, a movie came out in the 80s, and then it was based on a play. Incredible play, a great work of art. And this dude dropped knowledge for the ages. But one of the things The example is not going to work if you haven't seen it. But
you say Soulja Story. All I can think about is the song off Tupacalypse Now.
He probably named it.
Yeah, absolutely, I'm sure he did because he was a Broadway dork. Yeah,
it was like Denzel's like second role or something. Denzel is in it.
Oh, I know exactly what movie this is.
Howard Rollins.
Uh huh. Of course. Yeah. Damn, that is an old ass movie.
Yeah, it's an old ass movie. It's in the 80s. But
I think Robert Townsend was in that joint.
Was he? I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
David Allen Greer was in it.
David Allen Greer definitely was in it.
Yeah, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised if Robert Townsend wasn't in it. I'm surprised because every other black guy in the era was basically. But
yeah. I remember both David Allen Greer and Robert Townsend in that joint. And I barely remember the movie in terms of the content because I was young when I watched it. But all right, cool.
Yeah. In that movie, there's this guy CJ. It takes place in the 40s around World War II. And there's this guy, Waters, I think he's a colonel. I forget what his rank is, but he's the head of the troop. CJ is country as hell. And, you know, that's before the real great migration when, you know, being black was considered a lot of the times being kind of country. And this guy hated his southern roots. He the sadistic sergeant hated his southern roots. He hated southern music. He tried to listen to symphonies all the time and whatever. And this guy CJ was country as hell. He wasn't ashamed of being country. He didn't try to put on airs. He played blues music. He was very aw shucks, sincere. And it wasn't a performative act. It was just him. And the white people kind of loved his aw shucks authenticity. He was great at sports. He was great at all the things that Colonel Waters or Sergeant Waters thought that and was taught that he had to give up to get acceptance from white people. So it was like put on this whitewashing act and whatever. And then you come here being everything that, you know, I've been led to believe is bad for the race, is country, is kitschy, is ghetto and all that stuff. And to add insult to injury, these white people like you better than me. And it kind of, and other black people like you better than me, you know, even though I think I'm the one that's going to elevate the race. And he was so tormented with hatred for this guy, CJ, he ends up driving him to commit suicide. What I was going to say is, I feel like if that happened today, he would try to outplay CJ in the blues. He would have the same hatred and everything, but he'd be torn between trying to drive him to eradication and trying to outperform him. And that would be almost even worse because that adds even more cognitive dissonance.
Absolutely. Listen, I know a guy, you know, I keep putting these qualifiers on it. If you knew me personally, one thing you know is that I'm not afraid to talk about anybody. Mostly I like talking about them to their face. I think that's sincere. Yeah. I mean, I'm a person who had sat in the bar after a reading. It was called like an evening with writers of color in this city I was in. And it was a bunch of bougie niggas talking about nothing with a white audience applauding in the midst of all these police shootings. And I cursed the whole group out in front of everyone. Them, white people, black people, whomever, you know, I lost it. And I told them everything I thought. So I'm not afraid to do that. And that never happened. That's always been my personality. But I also don't want to just insult people. So I'm not going to say this person. But I know an author, an essayist. Now, this essayist, when I met him, unbeknownst to him, he had told a white friend of mine that he liked being in this small town he was in instead of Washington, D.C., because there were fewer black people. He was known not to speak to black people in public on the street. He had just about nothing but white friends. Another friend of mine was a bartender and said when he saw this guy went to an Ivy League school, he had his old Ivy League friends in. They were all getting drunk at the bar talking about their affinity for Ronald Reagan. Fast forward to 2020, after Obama gave these sorts of Negroes a new model to follow, he's writing essays about race and racism. And they're not good, but he found his blackness. And he found his blackness because I think he thought he was going to be able to push into whiteness. And you hit a certain age and a certain level where you realize they don't want you in front of them and they don't want to clap for you unless you're performing a certain script. And reluctantly, you better learn that script. And he did. And I see a whole lot of people like that. Now, what do you say to him? Because I don't feel animosity toward him. Kind of tragic. I think he's full of shit, but there's something tragic about it. And I wish he could live his identity. I do agree that blackness is not a monolith. And in fact, that his form of blackness is no less legitimate than mine. That is his personal life. You know, it's when people like that begin to come into my area and borrow from my identity and express expertise and insight that they lack and push me out. and push people like me out of ever speaking in front of people and really provoking them and being critical and thoughtful, that's when I start saying, all right, hold up here.
And then also at the same time, spreading like harmful tropes. Like, for example, if you just want to go in there and be an imposter or, you know, be whatever and get some coin, it's like, I don't like it, but so be it, you know, just stay out of my way. But they will try to like ankle bite and backstab other people that they view as, oh, this person might expose me as an imposter, or this person might you know.
Absolutely. They want you out the room immediately.
Yeah, they want you out of the room immediately. But also, also looking in front of white people and spread some of the worst tropes about, like right now it's trendy to say about straight black men that they terrorize the black community and they're enacting white supremacy and they worship white supremacy and they want to come in and that everyone is double oppressed because white supremacy is kicking their ass, but also straight black men are going around kicking everyone's ass too. And so and I'm like, when you say that, you're legitimizing the same things that cops say before they shoot black people, that this guy is just a natural threat, he's violent, it's better to shoot first and ask later. Like, that's very irresponsible. Don't just tell people that straight black men are just animals that kill and oppress everybody, because there's bigger repercussions to that. Like, especially for such a small price, like for like your 30 pieces, that's like that's nothing. Like a couple of freelance writing jobs is not worth putting that into into the atmosphere, you know?
Sure. It's lamentable at best, and it's despicable at worst.
So I'm going to end it by reading a paragraph that I thought was really good in your piece, and then I'll give you the floor to bring up whatever you want to bring up or plug anything you want to plug. But
sure.
I really like this part. You said, one student presciently noted, suffering is an insufficient foundation for community and identity. Then you add, so is grievance, which raises the questions, why are so many black thinkers and writers frequently willing to reduce black identity to grievance and pain for consumption by a white audience? To give her credit, at the same time she was performing and profiting from this identity forged in grievance, Krug's peers and former students seem to agree she produced quality scholarship. Her minstrelsy, at the very least, didn't appear to be a cynical ploy to mask mediocre thinking. But what do we make of the booming market for facile meditations that have been produced by this recent period of intense reckoning with American racism? A black colleague recently referred to the dramatic uptick in performative blackness in self-help books on anti-racism as social justice disaster capitalism. The market has opened wide in the wake of crisis, killings by police, increasing economic inequity, the normalization of overt forms of racism we hoped were relegated to the past, and grifters and milquetoast scholars are rushing in to exploit the demand, getting while the getting's good. To quote my colleague again, I don't think I've seen so many poorly rendered books about race meet with so much success. And what that made me think of was how in the first couple of weeks of George Floyd, you had all these people really talking about defund the police and agitate change. And then by the time the I called them the untalented tent, by the time they got a hold of the narrative, it suddenly became about getting more black people in TV writing rooms and and getting more black people in different publications, and all these old actors and actresses from old shows were rehashing old beefs they had with their white co-workers, like the girl from the show Glee and a bunch of other girls were airing out all this old stuff. And that's what that paragraph totally reminded me of, like the door kicks open and everyone just starts getting in while the getting's good. And the whole article is very good. I think everyone should read it. It's Higher Education and the Illusion of Meritocracy. Oh, I remembered one point I wanted to bring up to you. There's this article by Patton Oswalt called Geek Culture Has to Die or something like that. Let me remember what it was. It was, and I sent it to you because it's a kind of weird article that seems out of the, it's called Wake Up Geek Culture, Time to Die. And what he was talking about was how back in the days to be a geek in his day was hard. You had to like go to a convention, someone had to drive you, your mom had to drive you as a kid. Then the convention was in like the basement of a hotel. And then there'd be some weird dude in a trench coat with a bunch of shoe boxes, and he'd have like a complete DVD set of Doctor Who. And you had to give whatever allowance money you had and buy like four DVDs, and your friend had to buy four DVDs, and it was like hard won knowledge, and you had the fanzines and the Usenet and all this stuff. But he was saying that now with the internet and instant access, accessibility and streaming and this content explosion, you can like wake up one day and say, I want to become a Doctor Who expert. And then in 2 weeks off of Wikipedia and streaming on Netflix, you've watched like five seasons of Doctor Who. And he's like, you can get this broad knowledge, but there's no depth. And if you talk to an old school Doctor Who fan who talks about, you know, the history and things that happened, like, you know, like remember in 89 when the fans were arguing about the fifth Doctor Who and how everyone hated him and stuff like that person would kind of sit there clueless, because that's something that you have to have kind of lived experience as a fan to do. Like the cram session doesn't do it. And I feel like we have, even though that article was like from 2010 and it was about geek culture, I kind of realized like we have that type of blackness now. We have Wikipedia blackness, or, you know.
Absolutely. You know what it is? It's the difference between the salt and pepper songs that were for white people and the salt and pepper songs that were good. You knew that because you were in the culture. You knew Shoop and What a Man was trash. Now, if you were to go back in time and you just looked at the chart position and you listen, you might say, hey, this is a dope song. It succeeded. But that's not how cultural success and validation was measured. You know, like, I feel that we've lost that sort of cultural connection. So now a song like that actually would be celebrated as black excellence rather than a cynical cash grab trying to appeal to a white audience. Now, beyond that, what you're saying about Wikipedia, it makes me think of cooking and driving. Like, New York City, I used to know like the back of my hand. I earned that knowledge. I went everywhere in New York City except Staten Island. Yeah. But, you know, I went that's everybody's everywhere. Story. You walked down every alley. You took every train. Like, somebody asked you where it was, you tell them how to get there. And you knew where to turn and all that kind of shit. That's different from how I've approached cities. You know, my approach always is to get to know a city. I used to ride buses when I lived in Minneapolis. I'd ride all over the town because I wanted to know the city. You got to get to know a city you live in. But now it's like, yo, I got the GPS. You can go to 100 destinations in a city and never really know how to get there. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Or my mother knows how to cook. I cook a lot of good food, but I don't know how to cook. Mm. See, because I have recipes at my disposal and I follow those motherfuckers. But if you took me and my mother into a kitchen and said, yo, you can't use the internet. Here's 14 ingredients. What are you going to cook? My mother would beast.
Yeah.
Because she's been cooking her whole life. She experientially is a cook. She understands what the fucking ingredients do and how they go together. Like, that's instinctual for her. Where I would be like, ah, oh, shit, do I have 2 tablespoons or 4? I don't know. Like, you know what I mean?
I'll even add an extra degree to that, man. Like, you know how you describe being in New York? I used to be that same way. I used to know everything like the back of my hand experientially. Now, even in New York, even places that I know how to get to, I use GPS anyway because I like the traffic. I like knowing where the traffic's going to be. So even when I know how to get places, I started using GPS, right? And what I started realizing is even when you experientially know stuff, sometimes if you let yourself get into that instant access, internet, Wikipedia culture, your experience knowledge can atrophy. Like, I've started finding myself forgetting things that I used to know like the back of my hand. You know, when the GPS is not around, I suddenly have to actively recall. And like, was it this way or was it this street? So I think that's another danger. Not only are you getting these weak fans or these weak aficionados, I think a lot of people who used to be strong are getting weaker. And I just remember something else you said about growing up with these people in prep school and stuff. I think another source of the rage, there's a really good book called The Rage of a Privileged Class by Ellis Coase. And it came to the same conclusion that you did, that it's actually these suburban people who are the most mad. And it's because of their exposure. They have a better knowledge of white people. I think kind of when you don't grow up with white people, but you integrate late, you kind of have any illusions that you ever were or were going to be one of them, or that you had an illusion of honorary whiteness, or they don't see color. You know, you kind of look around and see, this is not my life, this ain't shit. What I see in the TV is not really what's around me. I'm different. And you make kind of peace with it. And you kind of arrive to white people when you finally see them as an other. Like, you realize that, you know, I'm an other, they're an other to me, and let's see how we can make this work, you know? But I think when you kind of grow up as the only black kid in your school, all your friends are white, maybe you run team, you were a cheerleader, I think those people have a time where they have to discover and get a wake-up call that, okay, I'm only going to get so far, or they do see me as an other after all. I'm not like a special snowflake they think they're as other from the bad black people. Like they take pride in when their white friends tell them, you're not like the bad black people. They actually take pride in it, you know, until they kind of realize, no, deep down they do think I'm like them. They just think I'm...
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think
it's like the terrible Chris Rock bit.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And I think that's kind of where the rage is, that they thought at one point, you know, if not that they were white, but maybe that they were honorary white, you know, like recognized as some kind of special mm-hmm. snowflake. And then they realize, no, they still kind of see you. Not only do they see you as another nigger, but they think you don't even have the parts of a nigger that makes a nigger cool. You know, you don't, you know, mm-hmm. so you're not good at being black, and you're not, and you're never going to be white. And mm-hmm. that forces them to begrudgingly kind of re-embrace that performance that,
sure.
yeah.
You're in a cultural no man's land, and now you have to re-embrace a performance of a group of people that you actually don't want to be caught dead around.
Yep. But the paradox of it is they're re-embracing the cultural performance of that group that they don't want to be caught dead around as a way to backdoor, hopefully get into honorary whiteness or whatever. That's the paradox of it. They're going kind of back into that cultural performance as a way to get in. I couldn't get into the front door, but maybe this mm-hmm. is my way to get into those country clubs, to get into those. Like, it's still that same childhood goal. That's why I'm saying it's like that childhood wound that you're trying to heal. This is that childhood wound of you weren't able to be honorary white. This is your chance to do it. And that's where that narcissistic rage comes from every time they get a wake-up call that it's not going to happen, that wounding happens. And I think that's what they're really angry about. But they have to paint it as, I'm angry at George Floyd. Because the other one doesn't sound noble.
Sure.
Yeah. And what's the last thing you want to say? I've kept you here long enough. I appreciate your patience.
Not a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
No, of course. I don't have anything to promote. I don't promote anything, man. I don't, you know, you can follow me on social media or you can't. That's fine. But you know, I worry. And, you know, when I worry about this, this is something I had noted early on, was that in these circles that I had traveled in terms of prep school and liberal arts school, that meritocracy for really wealthy people was not about, you know, sort of what the myth of meritocracy is. You work hard and you get what you deserve, right? It was really just about wanting and ambition. American meritocracy for people with money is, I want this and therefore I deserve it. I'm starting to see Black people embrace that in a way that they didn't, you know, and that scares me, which is just to say, we define ourselves in such capitalist terms at this point. And I understand it. I do. Because Black people are ultra educated, respective to our starting point. Like, we go, we get education, we try to attain some piece of the American dream through all of the ways that they pretend it exists, and it doesn't work. Education has not helped Black people in this country. We still don't earn as much money as high school dropouts, even when we're educated, who are white, right? And so there's been a rejection of this and an embrace of the capitalist ethos that runs America, and that liberation can only be achieved through capital. Now, what that does, unfortunately, you know, is it encourages this sort of pure ambition that deregulates Black art, Black writing, Black hip hop, Black everything, right? And it has debased the discourse among Black people, and it's leading us to a barren place where we just will get nothing out of it. There may be a few cynical people who pile up bags of money by rehearsing or reciting these rehearsed talking points, but this nebulous concept of Black excellence and us supporting these people on Twitter who have nothing to offer and who do nothing, they're not activists, they're not intellectuals, who are just spokespeople and mascots, is something that will absolutely, you know, I don't know what's going to bring us closer to meaningful change, but I know that this is moving us completely off the path to it. And so it's a little disturbing, and I really hope we reassess where we've sunk to. You know, the other day, what was it, Time Magazine? I don't think they've been particularly relevant in years. They've sunk to tabloid level, but, you know, I saw someone excitedly retweeting, this is what I'm here for, this content. Dwayne Wade profiled by John Legend.
Oh, God.
And I'm like, John Legend makes saccharine light FM ballads, and Dwayne Wade is an extremely wealthy basketball player with a trans daughter. Those two people are not going to enlighten me, all right? And the buy-in to celebrity culture as the end-all, be-all is so profoundly disheartening.
Oh yeah.
I'm afraid, you know, for this society, you know, MLK was right, you know, when he talked about worrying that he was integrating his people into a burning house. But I knew that. I knew how sociopathic the roots of American society were. I knew that America was a society addicted to nostalgia at the expense of historical reckoning. I didn't know black people would embrace that. Of course. And it seems that we've actually, when you talk about the flattening of black identity, the black identity is becoming more and more American in the worst ways possible. It's aspirational in a way that negates the reality of it. And that scares me. But no, it's a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I don't really get a lot of chances to talk to like a New York City guy from like my generation. So it's like, I feel like I know you already. like it's a very familiar feeling conversation. I really enjoyed it a lot. But yeah, you're always welcome back. You have an article that you think, you know,
for sure.
It's pretty good. You know, just always hit me up and I'll do the same. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And everybody check it out. Check him out, Jason A. England. And set up a Google alert for his name so you can always get anything he writes. And have a good one, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Take care. We'll keep communicating.